Chapter 17 The croquet party to which the Princess Tverskaya had invited Anna was to consist of two ladies and their admirers. These two ladies were the chief representatives of a new select Petersburg circle, nicknamed, in imitation of some imitation, Les Sept Merveilles du Monde. These ladies belonged to a circle which, though of the highest society, was utterly hostile to that in which Anna moved. Moreover, Stremov, one of the most influential people in Petersburg, and the elderly admirer of Liza Mikhailova, was Alexei Alexandrovitch's enemy in the political world. From all these considerations, Anna had not meant to go, and the hints in Princess Tverskaya's note referred to her refusal. But now Anna was eager to go, in the hope of seeing Vronsky. Anna arrived at Princess Tverskaya's earlier than the other guests. At the same moment as she entered, Vronsky's footman, with side whiskers combed out like a chamberlain, went in too. He stopped at the door, and taking off his cap, let her pass. Anna recognized him, and only then recalled that Vronsky had told her the day before that he wouldn't come. Most likely he was sending a note to say so. As she took off her outer garment in the hall, she heard the footman, even pronouncing his R's, like a chamberlain, say, "From the Count for the Princess," and deliver the note. She longed to question him as to where his master was. She longed to turn back and send him a letter to come and see her, or to go see him herself. But neither the first, nor the second, nor the third course was possible. Already she heard bells ringing to announce her arrival ahead of her, and Princess Tverskaya's footman was standing at the open door, waiting for her to go forward into the inner rooms. "The princess is in the garden. They will inform her immediately. Would you be pleased to walk into the garden?" announced another footman in another room. The position of uncertainty, of indecision, was still the same as at home. Worse, in fact, since it was impossible to take any step, impossible to see Vronsky, and she had to remain here among outsiders, in company so uncongenial to her present mood. But she was wearing a dress that she knew suited her. She was not alone. All around was that luxurious setting of idleness that she was used to, and she felt less wretched than at home. She was not forced to think about what she was to do. Everything happened automatically. On meeting Betsy coming toward her in a white gown that struck her by its elegance, Anna smiled to her, just as she always did. Princess Tverskaya was walking with Tushkevich and a young lady, a relation who, to the great joy of her parents in the provinces, was spending the summer with the fashionable princess. There was probably something unusual about Anna, for Betsy noticed it at once. "I slept badly," answered Anna, looking intently at the footman who came to meet them, and, as she supposed, brought Vronsky's note. "How glad I am you've come," said Betsy. "I'm tired, and was just longing to have some tea before they come. You might go," she turned to Tushkevich, "with Masha, and try the croquet lawn over there where they've been cutting it. We shall have time to talk a little over tea. We'll have a cosy chat, eh?" she said in English to Anna, with a smile, pressing the hand with which she held a parasol. "Yes, especially as I can't stay very long with you. I'm forced to go on to old Madame Reed. I've been promising to go for a century," said Anna, to whom lying, alien as it was to her nature, had become not merely simple and natural in society, but a positive source of satisfaction. Why she said this, which she had not thought of a second before, she couldn't have explained. She had said it simply from the reflection that as Vronsky wouldn't be here, she had better secure her own freedom and try to see him somehow. But why she had spoken of old Madame Reed, whom she had to go and see, as she had to see many other people, she couldn't have explained. And yet, as it afterward turned out, had she contrived the most cunning devices to meet Vronsky, she could have thought of nothing better. "No, I'm not going to let you go for anything," answered Betsy, looking intently into Anna's face. "Really, if I were not fond of you, I would feel offended. One would think you were afraid my society would compromise you. Tea in the small dining room, please," she said, half closing her eyes, as she always did when addressing the footman. Taking the note from him, she read it. "Alexei is playing us false," she said in French. "He writes that he can't come. she added in a tone as simple and natural as though it could never enter her head that Vronsky could mean anything more to Anna than a game of croquet. Anna knew that Betsy knew everything, but hearing how she spoke of Vronsky before her, she almost felt persuaded for a minute that she knew nothing. "Oh," said Anna, indifferently, as though not greatly interested in the matter, and she went on, smiling. "How can you or your friends compromise anyone?" This playing with words, this hiding of a secret, had a great fascination for Anna, as, indeed, it has for all women. And it wasn't the necessity of concealment, not the aim with which this concealment was contrived, but the process of concealment itself that attracted her. "I can't be more Catholic than the Pope," she said. "Stremov and Liza Makarlova, why, they're the cream of society. Besides, they're received everywhere, and I," she laid special stress on the I, "have never been strict and intolerant. It's simply that I haven't the time." "No. You don't care, perhaps, to meet Stremov? Let him and Alexei Alexandrovich tilt at each other in the committee. That's no affair of ours. But in the world he's the most amiable man I know, and a devoted croquet player. You'll see." "And in spite of his absurd position as Liza's lovesick swain at his age, you ought to see how he carries the absurd situation off. He's very nice." "Sappho Stoltz, you don't know." "Oh, that's a new kind. Quite new." Betsy said all this, and at the same time, from her good-humoured, shrewd glance, Anna felt that she partly guessed her plight and was hatching something for her benefit. They were in the little study. "I must write to Alexei, though." And Betsy sat down at the table, scribbled a few lines, and put the note in an envelope. "I'm writing him to come to dinner. I've one lady extra and no man to take her in. Look at what I've said. Will that persuade him? Excuse me. I must leave you for a minute. Would you seal it up, please, and send it off?" she said from the door. "I have to give some directions." Without a moment's thought, Anna sat down at the table with Betsy's letter, and without reading it, wrote below, "It's essential for me to see you. Come to the Reed Garden. I shall be there at 6 o'clock." She sealed it up, and as Betsy was coming back, in her presence, handed the note to be sent off. At tea, which was brought them on a little tea-table in the cool drawing-room, the cosy chat promised by Princess Tverskaya before the arrival of her visitors really did come off between the two women. They criticised the people they were expecting, and the conversation fell upon Liza Makarlova. "She's very sweet, and I always liked her," said Anna. "You ought to like her. She raves about you. Yesterday she came up to me after the races and was in despair at not finding you. She says you're a real heroine out of a novel, and that if she were a man she would do all sorts of mad things for your sake. Stremov says she does that as it is." "But do tell me, please. I never could make it out," said Anna, after being silent for some time, speaking in a tone that showed that she was not asking an idle question, but what she was asking was of more importance to her than it should have been. "Do tell me, please, what are her relations with Prince Kaluzhsky, Mishka, as he's called? I've met them so little. What are they?" Betsy smiled with her eyes and looked intently at Anna. "It's a new fashion," she said. "They've all adopted it. They've flung their caps over the windmills. But there are ways and ways of flinging them." "Yes, but what are her relations precisely with Kaluzhsky?" Betsy broke into unexpectedly mirthful and irrepressible laughter, a thing that rarely happened with her. "You're encroaching on Princess Miyakaya's special domain now. That's the question of an enfant terrible." And Betsy obviously tried to restrain herself, but couldn't, and went off into peals of that infectious laughter that people laugh who do not laugh often. "You'd better ask them," she said, between tears of laughter. "No, you laugh," said Anna, laughing too, in spite of herself. "But I never could understand it. I can't understand the husband's role in it." "The husband?" Liza Mikhailova's husband carries her comforter and is always ready to be of use. But anything more than that in reality, no one cares to inquire. You know, in decent society, one doesn't talk or even think of certain details of dress. That's how it is with this. "Will you be at Madame Rolandaki's fete?" asked Anna, to change the conversation. "I don't think so," answered Betsy, and without looking at her friend, she began filling the little transparent cups with fragrant tea. Putting a cup before Anna, she took out a cigarette, and fitting it into a silver holder, she lighted it. "It's like this, you see. I'm in a fortunate position," she began, quite serious now, as she took up her cup. "I understand you, and I understand Liza. Liza, now, is one of those naive natures that, like children, don't know what's good and what's bad. Anyway, she didn't comprehend it when she was very young, and now she's aware that the lack of comprehension suits her. Now, perhaps, she doesn't know on purpose," said Betsy with a subtle smile. "But anyway, it suits her. The very same thing, don't you see, may be looked at tragically and turned into a misery, or it may be looked at simply and even humorously. Possibly you are inclined to look at things too tragically." "How I should like to know other people, just as I know myself," said Anna, seriously and dreamily. "Am I worse than other people, or better? I think I'm worse." Enfant terrible," Betsy repeated. "But here they are." Chapter 18. They heard the sound of steps, and a man's voice, then a woman's voice and laughter, and immediately thereafter there walked in the expected guests, Sappho Stoltz and a young man beaming with excess of health, known as Vaska. It was evident that ample supplies of beefsteak, truffles, and burgundy never failed to reach him at the fitting hour. Vaska bowed to the two ladies and glanced at them, but only for a second. He walked after Sappho into the drawing-room and followed her about as though he were chained to her, keeping his sparkling eyes fixed on her as though he wanted to eat her. Sappho Stoltz was a blonde beauty with black eyes. She walked with brisk little steps in high-heeled shoes and shook hands with the ladies vigorously, like a man. Anna had never met this new celebrity and was struck by her beauty, the exaggerated extreme to which her dress was carried, and the boldness of her manners. On her head there was such a superstructure of soft golden hair, her own and artificial, that her head was equal in size to the elegantly rounded bust, of which so much was exposed in front. The impulsive abruptness of her movements was such that at every step the lines of her knees and the upper part of her legs were distinctly visible under her dress, and the question involuntarily arose as to where, in the undulating, piled-up mountain of material at the back, the real body of the woman, so small and slender, so naked in front, and so hidden behind and below, really came to an end. Betsy made haste to introduce her to Anna. "Just imagine, we all but ran over two soldiers," she began telling them at once, using her eyes, smiling and throwing back her train, which she had jerked too much to one side. "I drove here with Vaska. Ah, do be sure, you don't know each other." And mentioning his surname, she introduced the young man, and, reddening a little, broke into a ringing laugh at her mistake, that is, at her having called him Vaska to a stranger. Vaska bowed once more to Anna, but he said nothing to her. He addressed Sappho. "You've lost your bet. We got here first. Pay up," said he, smiling. Sappho laughed still more festively. "Not just now," said she. "Oh, all right. I'll have it later." "Very well, very well. Oh, yes." She turned suddenly to Princess Betsy. "How could I? I positively forgot it. I brought you a visitor, and here he comes." The unexpected young visitor whom Sappho had invited and whom she'd forgotten was, however, a person of such importance that, in spite of his youth, both the ladies rose on his entrance. He was a new admirer of Sappho's. He now dogged her footsteps like Vaska. Soon after, Prince Kaluzhsky arrived, and Liza Mikhailova with Stremov. Liza Makarlova was a thin brunette with an oriental, languid type of face, and, as everyone used to say, exquisite, enigmatic eyes. The tone of her dark dress, Anna immediately observed and appreciated the fact, was in perfect harmony with her style of beauty. Liza was as soft and relaxed as Sappho was smart and hard. But to Anna's taste, Liza was far more attractive. Betsy had said to Anna that she had adopted the pose of an innocent child, but when Anna saw her, she felt that this was not the truth. She really was both innocent and corrupt, but a sweet and passive woman. It was true that her tone was the same as Sappho's, that like Sappho she had two men, one young and one old, tacked on to her and devouring her with their eyes. But there was something in her that was superior to what surrounded her. There was in her the glow of the real diamond among imitations. This glow shone out in her exquisite, truly enigmatic eyes. The weary and at the same time passionate glance of those eyes, encircled by dark rings, impressed one by its perfect sincerity. Everyone looking into those eyes thought he knew her wholly, and knowing her, could not but love her. At the sight of Anna, her whole face lighted up at once with a smile of delight. "Oh, how glad I am to see you," she said, going up to her. "Yesterday at the races all I wanted was to get to you, but you'd gone away. I did so want to see you, yesterday especially. Wasn't it awful?" she said, looking at Anna with eyes that seemed to lay bare her soul. "Yes, I had no idea it would be so thrilling," said Anna, blushing. The company got up at this moment to go into the garden. "I'm not going," said Liza, smiling and settling herself close to Anna. "You won't go either, will you? Who wants to play croquet?" "Oh, I like it," said Anna. "There, how do you manage never to be bored by things? It's delightful to look at you. You're alive, but I'm bored." "How can you be bored? Why, you live in the liveliest set in Petersburg," said Anna. "Possibly the people who are not of our set are even more bored, but I certainly, are not happy, but awfully, awfully bored." Sappho, smoking a cigarette, went off into the garden with the two young men. Betsy and Stremov remained at the tea-table. "What, bored?" said Betsy. "Sappho says they did enjoy themselves tremendously at your house last night." "Oh, how dreary it all was," said Liza Makarlova. "We all drove back to my place after the races, and always the same people, always the same. Always the same thing. We lounged about on sofas all evening. What is there to enjoy in that? No. Do tell me how you manage never to be bored," she said, addressing Anna again. "One has but to look at you, and one sees here's a woman who may be happy or unhappy, but she isn't bored. Tell me how you do it." "I do nothing," answered Anna, blushing at these searching questions.
"That's the best way," Stremov put in.
Stremov was a man of 50, partly grey, but still vigorous-looking, very ordinary, but with an intelligent face full of character. Liza Makarlova was his wife's niece, and he spent all his leisure hours with her. On meeting Anna Karenina, as he was Alexei Alexandrovitch's enemy in the service, he tried, like a shrewd man and a man of the world, to be particularly cordial with her, the wife of his enemy. "Nothing," he put in with a subtle smile. "That's the very best way. I told you long ago," he said, turning to Liza Makarlova, "that if you don't want to be bored, you mustn't think you're going to be bored. It's just as you mustn't be afraid of not being able to fall asleep if you're afraid of sleeplessness." "That's exactly what Anna Arkadyevna has just said." "I would be very glad if I had said it, for it's not only clever but true," said Anna, smiling. "No, do tell me why it is one can't go to sleep and one can't help being bored." "To sleep well, one ought to work, and to enjoy oneself, one ought to work too." "What am I to work for when my work is of no use to anybody, and I can't and won't knowingly make a pretense about it?" "You're incorrigible," said Stremov, not looking at her, and he spoke again to Anna. Because he rarely met Anna, he could say nothing but commonplaces to her. But he said them, about when she was returning to Petersburg, and how fond Countess Lydia Ivanovna was of her, with an expression which suggested that he longed with his whole soul to please her and show his regard for her, and even more than that. Tushkevich came in, announcing that everyone was awaiting the other players to begin croquet. "No, don't go away. Please don't," pleaded Liza Merkalovna, hearing that Anna was going. Stremov joined in her entreaties.
"It's too violent a transition," he said, "to go from such company to old Madame Reed. And besides, you'll only give her a chance to talk scandal. While here you arouse very different feelings, of the most praiseworthy kind," he said to her.
Anna pondered for an instant in uncertainty. This shrewd man's flattering words, the naive, childlike affection shown her by Liza Merkalova, and all the social atmosphere she was used to, it was all so easy, and what was in store for her was so difficult, that she was for a minute undecided whether to remain, to put off a little longer the painful moment of explanation. But remembering what was in store for her alone at home if she didn't come to some decision, remembering that gesture, terrible even in memory, when she had clutched her hair in both hands, she said goodbye and left. Chapter 19. In spite of Vronsky's apparently frivolous life in society, he was a man who hated disorder. In his early youth, in the corps of pages, he had experienced the humiliation of a refusal when he had tried, being in difficulties, to borrow money, and since then he had never once put himself in the same position again. In order to keep his affairs straight, about 5 times a year, more or less frequently, according to circumstances, he would shut himself up alone and put all his affairs into shape. This he used to call his day of reckoning, or faire la lessive. On waking up the day after the races, Vronsky put on a white linen tunic, and without shaving or taking his bath, he spread money, bills and letters on the table, and began to work. Petritsky, who knew he was ill-tempered on such occasions, on waking up and seeing his comrade at the writing table, quietly dressed and went out without getting in his way. Every man who knows to the minutest details the complexity of the conditions surrounding him cannot help imagining that the complexity of these conditions and the difficulty of making them clear is something exceptional and personal, peculiar to himself, and never supposes that others are surrounded by just as complicated an array of personal affairs as he is. So, indeed, it seemed so to Vronsky. And not without inward pride, and not without reason, he thought that any other man would long ago have been in difficulties, and would have been forced to some dishonourable course if he had found himself in such a difficult position. But Vronsky felt that now especially it was essential for him to clear up and define his position if he were to avoid getting into difficulties. What Vronsky attacked first as being the easiest was his money problems. Writing out on notepaper in his minute script all that he owed, he added up the amount, and found that his debts amounted to 17,000 and some odd hundreds, which he left out for the sake of simplicity. Reckoning up his money and his bank book, he found that he had 1,800 rubles left, and nothing coming in before the new year. Going over again his list of debts, Vronsky copied it, dividing it into 3 categories. In the first, he put the debts he would have to pay at once, or for which he must in any case have the money ready, so that on demand for payment there could not be a moment's delay in paying. Such debts amounted to about 4,000, 1,500 for a horse, and 2,500 as surety for a young comrade, Venevsky, who had lost that sum to a card shark in Vronsky's presence. Vronsky had wanted to pay the money at the time, he had the amount then, but Venevsky and Yashvin had insisted that they would pay, and not Vronsky, who had not played. That was very fine, but Vronsky knew that in this dirty business, though his only share in it was undertaking by word of mouth to be surety for Venevsky, it was absolutely necessary for him to have the 2,500 rubles, so as to be able to fling it at the swindler, and have no more words with him. And so, for this first and most important category, he had to have 4,000 rubles. The second category, 8,000 rubles, consisted of less important debts. These were principally accounts incurred in connection with his racehorses, to the purveyor of oats and hay, the English trainer, and so on. He would have to pay some 2,000 rubles on these debts, too, in order to be quite free from anxiety. The last category of debts, to shops, to hotels, to his tailor, were such as need not be considered, so that he needed at least 6,000 rubles for current expenses, and he had only 1,800. For a man with 100,000 rubles of revenue, which was what everyone fixed as Vronsky's income, such debts, one would suppose, could hardly be embarrassing. But the fact was that he was far from having 100,000. His father's immense property, which alone yielded a yearly income of 200,000, was left undivided between the brothers. At the time when the elder brother, with a mass of debts, married Princess Varya Chirkova, the daughter of a Decembrist, without any fortune whatever, Alexei had given up to his elder brother almost the whole income from his father's estate, reserving for himself only 25,000 a year from it. Alexei had said at the time to his brother that that sum would be sufficient for him until he married, which he probably would never do. And his brother, who was in command of one of the most expensive regiments, and was only just married, could not decline the gift. His mother, who had her own separate property, had allowed Alexei 20,000 every year in addition to the 25,000 he had reserved, and Alexei had spent it all. Of late, his mother, incensed with him on account of his love affair and his leaving Moscow, had given up sending him the money, and in consequence of this, Vronsky, who had been in the habit of living on the scale of 45,000 a year, having received only 25,000 that year, now found himself in difficulties. To get out of these difficulties, he couldn't apply to his mother for money. Her last letter, which he had received the day before, had particularly exasperated him by the hints in it that she was quite ready to help him to succeed in the world and in the army, but not to lead a life that was a scandal to all good society. His mother's attempt to buy him stung him to the quick and made him feel colder than ever toward her. But he could not renege on the generous word when once it was uttered, even though he felt now, vaguely foreseeing certain eventualities in his intrigue with Madame Karenina, that this generous word had been spoken thoughtlessly, and that even though he was not married, he might need all 100,000 of his income. But it was impossible to renege. He had only to recall his brother's wife, to remember how that sweet, delightful Varya sought at every convenient opportunity to remind him that she remembered his generosity and appreciated it, to grasp the impossibility of taking back his gift. It was as impossible as beating a woman, stealing, or lying. Only one thing could and should be done, and Vronsky determined upon it without an instant's hesitation: to borrow money from a moneylender, 10,000 rubles, a proceeding that presented no difficulty, to cut down his expenses generally, and to sell his racehorses. Resolving on this, he promptly wrote a note to Rolandicky, who had more than once offered to buy horses from him. Then he sent for the Englishman and the moneylender, and divided what money he had according to the accounts he intended to pay. Having finished this business, he wrote a cold and cutting answer to his mother. Then he took out of his notebook 3 notes of Anna's, read them again, burned them, and remembering their conversation on the previous day, he sank into meditation. Chapter 20. Vronsky's life was particularly happy in that he had a code of principles which defined with unfailing certitude what he should and what he should not do. This code of principles covered only a very small circle of contingencies. But then the principles were never doubtful, and Vronsky, because he never went outside that circle, had never had a moment's hesitation about doing what he ought to do. These principles laid down as invariable rules: that one must pay a card shark, but need not pay a tailor; that one must never tell a lie to a man, but one may to a woman; that one must never cheat anyone, but one may cheat a husband; that one must never pardon an insult, but one may give one, and so on. These principles were possibly not reasonable and not good, but they were of unfailing certainty, and as long as he adhered to them, Vronsky felt that his heart was at peace, and he could hold his head up. Only quite lately, in regard to his relations with Anna, Vronsky had begun to feel that his code of principles did not fully cover all possible contingencies, and to foresee in the future difficulties and perplexities for which he could find no guiding clue. His present relation to Anna and to her husband was, to his mind, clear and simple. It was clearly and precisely defined in the code of principles by which he was guided. She was an honourable woman who had bestowed her love upon him, and he loved her, and therefore she was, in his eyes, a woman who had a right to the same, or even more, respect than a lawful wife. He would have had his hand chopped off before he would have allowed himself by a word, by a hint, to humiliate her, or even to fall short of the fullest respect a woman could look for. His attitude towards society, too, was clear. Everybody might know, might suspect it, but no one would dare speak of it. If anyone did so, he was ready to force him to be silent and to respect the non-existent honour of the woman he loved. His attitude toward the husband was the clearest of all. From the moment that Anna loved Vronsky, he had regarded his own right over her as the one thing unassailable. Her husband was simply a superfluous and tiresome person. No doubt he was in a pitiable position, but how could that be helped? The one thing the husband had a right to was to demand satisfaction with a weapon in his hand, and Vronsky was prepared for this at any minute. But of late, new inner relations had arisen between him and her which frightened Vronsky by their vagueness. Only the day before she had told him that she was pregnant, and he felt that this fact, and what she expected of him, called for something not fully defined in that code of principles by which he had hitherto steered his course in life. And he had been, indeed, caught unawares, and at the first moment when she spoke to him of her situation, his heart had prompted him to beg her to leave her husband. He had said that, but now, thinking things over, he saw clearly that it would be better to manage to avoid that, and at the same time, while he told himself so, he was afraid whether it was not wrong. "If I told her to leave her husband, that must mean uniting her life with mine. Am I prepared for that? How can I take her away now, when I have no money? Supposing I could arrange... But how can I take her away while I'm in the service? If I say that, I should be prepared to do it, that is. I should have the money and retire from the army." And he grew thoughtful. The question of whether to retire from the service or not brought him to the other, and perhaps the chief, though hidden, interest of his life, of which none knew but he. Ambition was the old dream of his youth and childhood, a dream which he didn't confess even to himself, though it was so strong that now this passion was even doing battle with his love. His first steps in the world and in the service had been successful, but 2 years before he had made a great mistake. Anxious to show his independence and to advance, he had refused a post that had been offered him, hoping that this refusal would heighten his value, but it turned out that he had been too bold, and he was passed over. And having, whether he liked or not, taken the position of an independent man, he carried it off with great tact and good sense, behaving as though he bore no grudge against anyone, didn't regard himself as injured in any way, and cared for nothing but to be left alone, since he was enjoying himself. In reality, he had ceased to enjoy himself as long ago as the year before when he went away to Moscow. He felt that this independent attitude of a man who might have done anything but cared to do nothing was already beginning to pall, that many people were beginning to think he was not really capable of anything but being a straightforward, good-natured fellow. His affair with Madame Karenina, by creating so much sensation and attracting general attention, had given him a fresh distinction which soothed his gnawing worm of ambition for a while. But a week before, that worm had been roused up again with fresh force. The friend of his childhood, a man of the same set, of the same coterie, his comrade in the corps of pages, Sepulkovskoy, who left school with him and had been his rival in class, in gymnastics, in their scrapes and their dreams of glory, had come back a few days before from Central Asia, where he had gained 2 steps up in rank, and an order rarely bestowed upon generals so young. As soon as he arrived in Petersburg, people began to talk about him as a newly risen star of the first magnitude. a classmate of Vronsky's and of the same age, he was a general, and was expecting a command which might have influence on the course of political events. While Vronsky, independent and brilliant and beloved by a charming woman though he was simply a cavalry captain who was readily allowed to be as independent as he liked.
Of course, I don't envy Sir Pukovskoy, and never could envy him, but his advancement shows me that one has but to watch one's opportunity, and the career of a man like me may be very rapidly made. 3 years ago he was in just the same position as I am in now. If I retire, I burn my ships. If I remain in the army, I lose nothing. She said herself she didn't wish to change her position. And with her love, I cannot feel envious of Sir Pukovskoy.
And slowly twirling his moustaches, he got up from the table and walked about the room. His eyes shone particularly brightly, and he enjoyed that confident, calm, and happy frame of mind which always came after he had thoroughly faced his situation. Everything was straight and clear, just as after former days of stock-taking. He shaved, took a cold bath, dressed, and went out. Chapter 21
"I've come to fetch you. Your washing lasted a good time today," said Petritsky. "Well, is it over?"
"It's over," answered Vronsky, smiling with his eyes only, and twirling the tips of his moustaches as circumspectly as though, after the perfect order into which his affairs had been brought, any overbold or rapid movement might disturb it.
"You're always just as if you'd come out of a bath after it," said Petritsky.
"I've come from Gritsko's," that was what they called the colonel.
"They're expecting you."
Vronsky, without answering, looked at his comrade, thinking of something else.
"Yes. Is that the music from his place?"
he said, listening to the familiar sounds of polkas and waltzes floating across to him.
"What's the occasion?"
"Sir Pukovskoy's come."
"Aha," said Vronsky.
"Why, I didn't know." The smile in his eyes gleamed more brightly than ever. Having once made up his mind that he was happy in his love, that he sacrificed his ambition to it, having anyway taken up this position, Vronsky was incapable of feeling either envious of Sir Pukovskoy or vexed with him for not coming first to him when he came to the regiment. Sir Pukovskoy was a good friend, and he was delighted he had come.
"Oh, I'm glad."
The colonel, Joman, had taken a large country house. The whole party were in the wide lower balcony. In the courtyard, the first objects that met Vronsky's eyes were a band of singers in white linen tunics standing near a barrel of vodka, and the robust figure of the colonel surrounded by officers. He had gone out as far as the first step of the balcony, and was loudly shouting over the band, which was playing an Offenbach quadrille, waving his arms and giving some orders to a few soldiers standing on one side. A group of soldiers, a sergeant, and several other non-commissioned officers, came up to the balcony with Vronsky. The colonel returned to the table, went out again onto the steps with a tumbler in his hand, and proposed the toast.
"To the health of our former comrade, the gallant general Prince Serpukhovskoy! Hurrah!"
The colonel was followed by Serpukhovskoy, who came out onto the steps, smiling, with a glass in his hand.
"You always get younger, Bondarienko,"
he said to the ruddy-cheeked, smart-looking sergeant, standing just before him, still youngish-looking, though doing his second term of service. It was 3 years since Vronsky had seen Serpukhovskoy. He looked more robust, had let his whiskers grow, but was still the same graceful creature, striking, not because of his good looks, but because of the delicacy and nobility of his face and figure. The only change Vronsky detected in him was that subdued, continual radiance of beaming content which settles on the faces of men who are successful and are sure of the recognition of their success by everyone. Vronsky knew that radiant air, and immediately observed it in Serpukhovskoy. As Serpukhovskoy came down the steps, he saw Vronsky. A smile of pleasure lighted up his face. He tossed his head upward and waved the glass in his hand, greeting Vronsky, and showing him by the gesture that he could not come to him before he went to the sergeant, who stood puckering up his lips, ready to be kissed.
"Here he is!" shouted the colonel. "Yashvin told me you were in one of your gloomy moods."
Serpukhovskaya kissed the moist, fresh lips of the gallant-looking sergeant, and wiping his mouth with his handkerchief, he went up to Vronsky. "How glad I am," he said, squeezing his hand and drawing him to one side.
"You look after him,"
the colonel shouted to Yashvin, pointing to Vronsky, and he went down below to the soldiers.
"Why weren't you at the races yesterday? I expected to see you there,"
said Vronsky, scrutinizing Serpukhovskaya.
"I did go, but late. Pardon me," he added, and he turned to his adjutant. "Please have this equally distributed among the men."
And he hurriedly took 3 100-ruble notes from his wallet, blushing a little.
"Vronsky, have anything to eat or drink?"
asked Yashvin.
"Hey, something for the Count to eat. Ah, here it is. Have a glass."
The party at the colonel's lasted a long while. There was a great deal of drinking. They tossed Serpukhovskaya in the air and caught him again several times. Then they did the same to the colonel. Then, to the accompaniment of the band, the colonel himself danced with Petritsky.
Then the colonel, who began to show signs of shakiness, sat down on a bench in the courtyard and began demonstrating to Yashvin the superiority of Russia over Prussia, especially in cavalry attack.
And there was a lull in the revelry for a moment. Serpukhovskaya went into the house to the washroom to wash his hands and found Vronsky there. Vronsky was drenching his head with water. He had taken off his coat and put his sunburned, hairy neck under the tap and was rubbing it and his head with his hands. When he had finished, Vronsky sat down next to Serpukhovskaya.
They both sat down in the washroom on a lounge, and a conversation began which was very interesting to both of them. "I've been hearing about you through my wife," said Serpukhovskaya. "I'm glad you've been seeing her pretty often." "She's friendly with Varya, and they're the only women in Petersburg I care about seeing," answered Vronsky, smiling. He smiled because he foresaw the turn the conversation would take, and he was glad of it. "The only ones?" Serpukhovskaya queried, smiling.
"Yes."
"And I heard news of you, but not only through your wife," said Vronsky, checking his hint by a stern expression. "I was greatly delighted to hear of your success, but not a bit surprised. I expected even more."
Serpukhovskaya smiled. Such an opinion of him was obviously agreeable to him, and he didn't think it necessary to conceal it.
"Well, I, on the contrary, expected less, I'll admit frankly. But I'm glad, very glad. I'm ambitious, that's my weakness, and I confess to it." "Perhaps you wouldn't confess to it if you hadn't been successful," said Vronsky. "I don't suppose so," said Serpukhovskaya, smiling again. "I won't say life wouldn't be worth living without it, but it would be dull. Of course, I may be mistaken, but I think I have a certain capacity for the line I've chosen, and that power of any sort in my hands, if it is to be, will be better than in the hands of a good many people I know," said Serpukhovskaya, with beaming consciousness of success. "And so the nearer I get to it, the better pleased I am." "Perhaps that's true for you, but not for everyone."
"I used to think so too, but here I live, and think life worth living not only for that."
"There, it's out. Here it comes," said Serpukhovskaya, laughing. "Ever since I heard about you, about your refusal, I began... Well, of course, I approved of what you did. But there are ways of doing everything. And I think your action was good in itself, but you didn't do it quite in the way you should have done it." "What's done can't be undone. And you know I never go back on what I've done. And besides, I'm all right." "All right for the time. But you're not satisfied with that?"
"I wouldn't say this to your brother.
He's a nice child, like our host here.
There he goes," he added, listening to the roar of hurrah.
"And he's happy. But that doesn't satisfy you." "I didn't say it did satisfy me."
"Yes. That's not the only thing."
"Such men as you are wanted."
"By whom?"
"By whom? By society, by Russia.
Russia needs men. She needs a political party, or else everything else goes and will go to the dogs. How do you mean? Bertenev's party against the Russian communists?
No, said Serpukhovskaya, frowning with vexation at being suspected of such an absurdity. Oh, that's a joke. That's always been and always will be. There are no communists.
But intriguing people have to invent a noxious, dangerous party. It's an old trick.
No! What's wanted is a powerful party of independent men like you and me.
But why so? Vronsky mentioned a few men who were in power. Why aren't they independent men?
Simply because they have not, or have not had from birth, an independent fortune. They've not had a name. They've not been born as close to the sun as we were. They can be bought either by money or by favour, and they have to find a support for themselves in inventing a policy. And they bring forward some notion, some policy that they don't believe in, that does harm. And the whole policy is really only a means to a government house, and so much income.
That's all it is, when you get a peep at their cards.
I may be inferior to them. Stupider, perhaps, though I don't see why I should be inferior to them. But you and I have one important advantage over them for certain, in being more difficult to buy. And such men are more needed than ever.
Vronsky listened attentively, but he was not so much interested in the meaning of the words as by the attitude of Serpukhovskaya, who was already contemplating a struggle with the existing powers, and already had his likes and dislikes in that higher world, while his own interest in the governing world did not go beyond the interests of his regiment. Vronsky felt, too, how powerful Serpukhovskaya might become through his obvious faculty for thinking things out and for taking things in. Through his intelligence and gift of words, so rarely met with in the world in which he moved. And ashamed as he was of the feeling, he felt envious.
"Still, I haven't the one thing of most importance for that," he answered. "I haven't the desire for power. I had it once, but it's gone."
"Excuse me, that's not true," said Serpukhovskaya, smiling.
"Yes, it is true. It's true. Now," Vronsky added, to be truthful. "Yes, it's true now. That's another thing. But that now won't last forever."
"Perhaps," answered Vronsky.
"You say perhaps," Serpukhovskaya went on, as though guessing his thoughts. "But I say for certain. And that's why I wanted to see you. Your action was just what it should have been. I see that. But you ought not to persevere in it. I only ask you to give me carte blanche. I'm not going to offer you my protection, though indeed, why shouldn't I protect you? You've protected me often enough. I should hope our friendship rises above all that sort of thing."
"Yes," he said, smiling to him as tenderly as a woman.
"Give me carte blanche, retire from the regiment, and I'll draw you up imperceptibly." "But you must understand that I want nothing," said Vronsky, "except that all should be as it is."
Serpukhovskaya got up and stood facing him.
"You say that all should be as it is. I understand what that means. But listen, we're the same age. You've known a greater number of women, perhaps, than I have."
Serpukhovskaya's smile and gestures told Vronsky that he mustn't be afraid, that he would be tender and careful in touching the sore spot.
"But I'm married. And believe me, in getting to know thoroughly one's wife, if one loves her, as someone has said, one gets to know all women better than if one knew thousands of them." "We're coming right away," Vronsky shouted to an officer who looked into the room and called them to the colonel. Vronsky was longing now to hear to the end and to know what Serpukhovskaya would say to him. "And here's my opinion for you. Women are the chief stumbling block in a man's career. It's hard to love a woman and do anything. There's only one way of having love conveniently without its being a hindrance. That's marriage." How am I to tell you what I mean?" said Serpukhovskaya, who liked similes. "Wait a minute. Wait a minute. Yes. Just as you can only carry a burden and do something with your hands when the burden is tied on your back. And that's marriage. And that's what I felt when I was married. My hands were suddenly set free. But to drag that burden about with you without marriage, your hands will always be so full that you can do nothing. Look at Mazenkov, at Krupov. They've ruined their careers for the sake of women.
What women? Said Vronsky, recalling the Frenchwoman and the actress with whom the two men he had mentioned were associated.
The firmer the woman's footing in society, the worse it is. That's much the same as not merely carrying the burden in your arms, but tearing it away from someone else.
You have never loved, Vronsky said softly, looking straight before him and thinking of Anna.
Perhaps. But you remember what I've said to you. And another thing. Women are all more materialistic than men. We make something immense out of love, but they are always matter of fact. Coming, coming, he cried to a footman who came in.
But the footman had not come to call them again, as he supposed. The footman brought Vronsky a note.
A man brought it from Princess Tverskaya.
Vronsky opened the letter and flushed crimson.
My head's beginning to ache. I'm going home, he said to Serpukhovskoye. Well, goodbye, then. Do you give me carte blanche? We'll talk about it later on. I'll look you up in Petersburg.
Chapter 22. It was past five already, and so, in order to be there quickly, and at the same time not to drive with his own horses, known to everyone, Vronsky got into Yashvin's hired carriage and told the driver to drive as quickly as possible. It was a roomy, old-fashioned carriage with seats for four. He sat in one corner, stretched his legs out on the front seat, and sank into meditation. A vague sense of the order into which his affairs had been brought, a vague recollection of the friendliness and flattery of Serpukhovskoye, who had considered him a man that was needed, and most of all, the anticipation of the interview before him, all blended into a general joyous sense of life. This feeling was so strong that he couldn't help smiling. He dropped his legs, crossed one leg over the other knee, and taking it in his hand, felt the springy muscle of the calf where it had been grazed the day before by his fall, and leaning back, he drew several deep breaths. I'm happy, very happy, he said to himself. He had often before had this sense of physical joy in his own body, but he had never felt so fond of himself, of his own body, as at that moment. He enjoyed the slight ache in his strong leg. He enjoyed the muscular sensation of movement in his chest as he breathed. The bright, cold August day, which had made Anna feel so hopeless, seemed to him keenly stimulating and refreshed his face and neck, which still tingled from the cold water. The scent of brilliantine on his whiskers struck him as particularly pleasant in the fresh air. Everything he saw from the carriage window, everything in that cold, pure air, in the pale light of the sunset, was as fresh and gay and strong as he was himself. The roofs of the houses shining in the rays of the setting sun, the sharp outlines of fences and angles of buildings, the figures of passers-by, the carriages that met him now and then, the motionless green of the trees and grass, the fields with evenly drawn furrows of potatoes, and the slanting shadows that fell from the houses and trees and bushes, and even from the rows of potatoes. Everything was bright, like a pretty landscape just finished and freshly varnished.
Faster, faster, he said to the driver, putting his head out of the window, and pulling a three-ruble note out of his pocket. He handed it to the man as he looked around. The driver's hand fumbled with something at the lamp, the whip cracked, and the carriage rolled rapidly along the smooth high road.
I want nothing, nothing but this happiness, he thought, staring at the ivory button of the bell in the space between the windows, and picturing to himself Anna just as he had seen her the last time.
And as I go on, I love her more and more. Here's the garden of the Reed country house. Where will she be? Where? How? Why did she decide on this place to meet me? And why did she write in Betsy's letter? He thought, and wondering now for the first time about it. But there was no time now for wonder. He called to the driver to stop before reaching the avenue, and opening the door, he jumped out while the carriage was moving and went into the avenue that led up to the house. There was no one in the avenue, but looking around to the right, he caught sight of her. Her face was hidden by a veil,
but he drank in with joyous eyes the special movement in walking, peculiar to her alone, the slope of the shoulders and the set of the head, and at once a sort of electric shock ran through him. With fresh force, he felt conscious of himself from the springing motions of his legs to the movements of his lungs as he breathed, and something set his lips twitching. Joining him, she pressed his hand tightly. "You're not angry that I sent for you. I absolutely had to see you," she said, and the serious and set line of her lips, which he saw under the veil, transformed his mood at once.
"I angry.
But how have you come? Where from?" "Never mind," she said. "Come along, I must talk to you." He saw that something had happened, and that the meeting would not be a joyous one. In her presence he had no will of his own. Without knowing the grounds of her distress, he already felt the same distress unconsciously passing over him.
"What is it?"
"What?" he asked her, pressing her arm with his elbow, and trying to read her thoughts in her face. She walked on a few steps in silence, gathering up her courage, and then suddenly she stopped. "I didn't tell you yesterday," she began, breathing quickly and painfully, "that coming home with Alexei Alexandrovich, I told him everything. Told him I couldn't be his wife. That... And told him everything." He heard her, unconsciously bending his whole figure down to her, as though hoping in this way to soften the seriousness of her position for her. But as soon as she had said this, he suddenly drew himself up, and a proud and stern expression came over his face.
"Yes, yes, that's better. 1,000 times better.
"I know how painful it was," he said. But she wasn't listening to his words. She was reading his thoughts from the expression of his face. She couldn't guess that that expression arose from the first idea that presented itself to Vronsky, that a duel was now inevitable. The idea of a duel had never crossed her mind, and so she put a different interpretation on this stern expression. When she got her husband's letter, she knew then, at the bottom of her heart, that everything would go on in the old way, that she would not have the strength of will to forego her position, to abandon her son, and to join her lover. The morning spent at Princess Tverskaya's had confirmed her still more in this. But this interview was still of the utmost gravity for her. She hoped that this interview would transform her position and save her. If, on hearing this news, he were to say to her, resolutely, passionately, without an instant's wavering, "Give up everything and come with me," she would give up her son and go away with him. But this news had not produced what she had expected in him. He simply seemed as though he was offended by something. "It was not in the least painful for me. It happened by itself," she said irritably. "And see?" She pulled her husband's letter out of her glove.
"I understand. I understand," he interrupted her,
taking the letter but not reading it, and trying to soothe her.
"The one thing I longed for, the one thing I prayed for, was to cut short this position so as to devote my life to your happiness."
"Why do you tell me that?" she said. "Do you suppose I can doubt it? If I doubted..."
"Who's that coming?" said Vronsky suddenly, pointing to two ladies walking toward them. "Perhaps they know us." And he hurriedly drew her after him into a side path.
"Oh, I don't care," she said. Her lips were quivering, and he thought that her eyes looked at him from under the veil with strange anger. "I tell you that's not the point. I can't doubt that. But see what he writes to me. Read it." She stood still again. Again, just as at the first moment of hearing of her break with her husband, Vronsky, on reading the letter, was unconsciously carried away by the natural feeling aroused in him by his own relation to the betrayed husband. Now, while he held the letter in his hands, he couldn't help picturing the challenge which he would most likely find at home today or tomorrow, and the duel itself, in which, with the same cold and haughty expression that his face was assuming at this moment, he would await the injured husband's shot, after having himself fired into the air. And at that instant there flashed across his mind the thought of what Serpukhovskaya had just said to him, and what he himself had been thinking in the morning.
that it was better not to bind himself, and he knew that this thought he couldn't tell her. Having read the letter, he raised his eyes to her, and there was no determination in them. She saw at once that he had been thinking about it before by himself. She knew that, whatever he might say to her, he wouldn't say all he thought. And she knew that her last hope had failed her. This was not what she had been expecting. "You see the sort of man he is," she said with a shaking voice. "He..."
"Forgive me, but I rejoice at it," Vronsky interrupted. "For God's sake, let me finish," he added, his eyes imploring her to give him time to explain his words. "I rejoice because things cannot possibly remain as he supposes."
"Why can't they?" Anna said, restraining her tears, and obviously attaching no sort of importance to what he said. She felt that her fate was sealed.
Vronsky meant that after the duel, inevitable, he thought, things could not go on as before. But he said something different. "It can't go on. I hope that now you will leave him. I hope..."
He was confused and reddened.
"That you will let me arrange and plan our life. Tomorrow," he was beginning. She didn't let him go on.
"But my child," she shrieked. "You see what he writes. I would have to leave him, and I can't and won't do that."
"But for God's sake, which is better? Leave your child or keep up this degrading position?"
"To whom is it degrading?"
"To all, and most of all, to you."
"You say degrading. Don't say that. Those words have no meaning for me," she said in a shaking voice. She didn't want him now to say what was untrue. She had nothing left her but his love, and she wanted to love him. "Don't you understand that from the day I loved you, everything has changed for me? For me there is one thing and one thing only, your love. If that's mine, I feel so exalted, so strong, that nothing can be humiliating to me. I'm proud of my position because... proud of being... proud..." She couldn't say what she was proud of. Tears of shame and despair choked her utterance. She stood still and sobbed. He felt, too, something swelling in his throat and twitching in his nose, and for the first time in his life he felt on the point of weeping. He could not have said exactly what it was that touched him so. He felt sorry for her, and he felt he couldn't help her, and with that he knew that he was to blame for her wretchedness and that he had done something wrong.
"Isn't a divorce possible?" he said feebly.
She shook her head, not answering.
"Couldn't you take your son and still leave him?"
"Yes, but it all depends on him. Now I must go to him," she said shortly. Her presentiment that all would again go on in the old way had not deceived her.
"On Tuesday I shall be in Petersburg, and everything can be settled."
"Yes," she said, "but don't let us talk any more of it." Anna's carriage, which she had sent away and ordered to come back to the little gate of the Reed Garden, drove up. Anna said goodbye to Vronsky and drove home. Chapter 23. On Monday, there was the usual sitting of the Commission of the 2nd of June.
Alexei Alexandrovich walked into the hall where the sitting was held, greeted the members and the president as usual, and sat down in his place, putting his hand on the papers laid ready before him. Among these papers lay the necessary evidence and a rough outline of the speech he intended to make. But he didn't really need these documents. He remembered every point, and didn't think it necessary to go over in his memory what he would say. He knew that when the time came, and when he saw his enemy facing him and studiously endeavouring to assume an expression of indifference, his speech would flow by itself better than he could prepare it now. He felt that the import of his speech was of such magnitude that every word of it would have weight. Meantime, as he listened to the usual report, he had the most innocent and inoffensive air. No one looking at his white hands with their swollen veins and long fingers, so softly stroking the edges of the white paper that lay before him, and that the air of weariness with which his head drooped on one side, would have suspected
that in a few minutes a torrent of words would flow from his lips that would arouse a fearful storm, setting the members shouting and attacking one another, and force the president to call for order. When the report was over, Alexei Alexandrovich announced in his subdued, delicate voice that he had several points to bring before the meeting regarding the settlement of the native population. All attention was turned upon him. Alexei Alexandrovich cleared his throat, and not looking at his opponent, but selecting, as he always did while he was delivering his speeches, the first person sitting opposite him, an inoffensive little old man who never had an opinion of any sort in the commission, he began to expound his views. When he reached the point about the fundamental and radical law, his opponent jumped up and began to protest. Stremov, who was also a member of the commission, and also stung to the quick, began defending himself, and altogether a stormy sitting followed. But Alexei Alexandrovich triumphed, and his motion was carried. Three new commissions were appointed, and the next day, in a certain Petersburg circle, nothing else was talked of but this meeting. Alexei Alexandrovich's success had been even greater than he had anticipated. The next morning, Tuesday, Alexei Alexandrovich, on waking up, recollected with pleasure his triumph of the previous day, and he couldn't help smiling, though he tried to appear indifferent when a chief secretary of his department, anxious to flatter him, informed him of the rumours that had reached him concerning what had happened in the commission. Absorbed in business with the chief secretary, Alexei Alexandrovich had completely forgotten that it was Tuesday, the day fixed by him for the return of Anna Arkadyevna, and he was surprised and received a shock of annoyance when a servant came in to inform him of her arrival. Anna had arrived in Petersburg early in the morning. The carriage had been sent to meet her in accordance with her telegram, and Alexei Alexandrovich should have known of her arrival. But when she arrived, he didn't meet her. She was told that he had not yet gone out, but was busy with his secretary. She sent word to her husband that she had come, went to her own room, and occupied herself in sorting out her things, expecting that he would come to her. But an hour passed. He didn't come. She went into the dining room on the pretext of giving some orders, and spoke loudly on purpose, expecting him to come out. But he did not come, though she heard him go to the door of his study as he parted from the chief secretary. She knew that he usually went out quickly to his office, and she wanted to see him before that, so that their attitude to one another might be defined. She walked across the drawing-room and went resolutely to him. When she went into his study, he was in official uniform, obviously ready to go out, sitting at a little table on which he rested his elbows, looking dejectedly before him. She saw him before he saw her, and she saw that he was thinking of her. On seeing her, he began to rise, but changed his mind. Then his face flushed hotly, a thing Anna had never seen before, and he got up quickly and went to meet her, looking not at her eyes, but above them at her forehead and hair. He went up to her, took her by the hand, and asked her to sit down. "I'm very glad you've come," he said, sitting down beside her, and obviously wishing to say something, he stuttered. Several times he tried to begin to speak, but stopped. In spite of the fact that preparing herself for meeting him she had schooled herself to despise and reproach him, she didn't know what to say to him, and she felt sorry for him. And so the silence lasted for some time. "Is Seryozha well?" he said. And not waiting for an answer, he added, "I will not be dining at home today. I have got to go out at once." "I had thought of going to Moscow," she said. "No, you did quite right to come," he said, and was silent again. Seeing that he was powerless to begin the conversation, she began herself. "Alexei Alexandrovich," she said, looking at him, and not lowering her eyes under his persistent gaze at her hair. "I'm a guilty woman. I'm a bad woman. But I am the same as I was, as I told you then, and I've come to tell you that I can change nothing." "I've asked you nothing about that," he said, all at once, resolutely, and with hatred, looking her straight in the face. "That
was as I had supposed. Under the influence of anger, he apparently regained complete possession of all his faculties.
"But, as I told you then, and have written to you," he said in a thin, shrill voice, "I repeat now that I am not bound to know this. I ignore it. Not all wives are as kind as you to be in such a hurry to communicate such pleasant news to their husbands."
He laid special emphasis on the word pleasant.
"I shall ignore it as long as the world knows nothing of it, as long as my name is not disgraced. And so I simply inform you that our relations must be just as they have always been, and that only in the event of your letting yourself be compromised shall I be obliged to take steps to secure my honour."
"But our relations cannot be the same as before," Anna began in a timid voice, looking at him with dismay. When she saw once more those composed gestures, heard that shrill, childish, and sarcastic voice, her aversion for him extinguished her pity for him, and she felt only afraid. But at all costs she wanted to make clear her position. "I cannot be your wife while I—" she began. He laughed a cold and venomous laugh.
"The manner of life you have chosen is reflected, I suppose, in your ideas. I have too much respect or contempt, or both. I respect your past and despise your present. That I was far from the interpretation you put on my words."
Anna sighed and bowed her head.
"Though, indeed, I fail to comprehend how, with the independence you show," he went on, getting heated, "telling your husband of your infidelity and apparently seeing nothing reprehensible in it, that you should consider it reprehensible to perform a wife's duties to her husband."
"Alexei Alexandrovitch, what is it you want of me?"
"I want you not to meet that man here, and to conduct yourself so that neither the world nor the servants can reproach you. Not to see him." "That's not much, I think." "And in return you will enjoy all the privileges of a faithful wife without fulfilling her duties. That's all I have to say to you. Now, it's time for me to go. I'm not dining at home."
He got up and moved toward the door. Anna got up too. Bowing in silence, he let her pass before him.